From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I dropped into a nearby kitchen store recently that was holding a baking class, specifically one about gluten-free and even grain-free baking. It would be nice to have some go-to recipes for guests who more frequently are on restricted diets, I figured. But even more than that, I was actually hoping for some decoding of all those packages at the market of familiar-sounding but also completely unfamiliar flours. While they're milled from plants I know, like almond and coconut, sorghum or garbanzo, brown rice, and more, what do you do with them? Which works for what use, and what do they taste like anyhow? Apparently, I'm not alone in my curiosity. The teacher, Elizabeth Barbone of GlutenFreeBaking.com and a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America, said that at many of her workshops, everyone is happy to just talk flours because it's so perplexing when you're on a restricted diet. She also said that, like in my case, many of her students are not restricted by food allergies themselves, but attending the class in behalf of someone else. In the room were grandparents wanting to bake for their grandkids, an older sister with her younger sister who had severe allergies, plus parents and friends. Elizabeth, author of the new book, World's Easiest Paleo Baking, and of two titles on gluten-free cooking and baking before that, is my guest today to take us on an expert-guided tour of all those new-to-me ingredients. Hi, Elizabeth. How are you?
Hi, Margaret. It's a delight to be here today.
Yes, yes. Well, congratulations on the new book, World's Easiest Paleo Baking.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk about your background, and then we'll talk about what paleo is, because people may not know that. But your bio on glutenfreebaking.com explains that you were born with severe food allergies. So I have to ask, why did you go to professional cooking school?
That is a great question. And I actually went to cooking school because of those allergies. You know, I was born allergic, as my mother likes to joke, allergic to everything. I had dairy allergies as a child. I was egg allergic. Those two have resolved, but I'm still highly allergic to most tree nuts. I can't do soy, sesame. I have celiac disease. So I can't eat wheat or gluten.
Oh my goodness.
But yeah, it's a lot. But, you know, I was gifted with a mom who loved to bake, and I loved watching her in the kitchen. And unfortunately, there weren't a lot of recipes for food allergic folks. So she did really, really well, but I wanted to learn sort of the backbone of baking science. Like, you know, what does flour do? What does sugar bring to a recipe besides sweetness? So off to the Culinary Institute of America I went, never intending to work in a bake shop, never intending to work in food service. I really wanted to learn the mechanics of baking so I could take that and then apply it to allergen-friendly baking.
Because you wanted to taste some of those familiar flavors and be able to help. You have anecdotes in the book about, I think it was when you were a child, the whoopie pie that the neighbor's mom had for snack time or something, and you couldn't have the whoopie pie. And, you know, it's those types of, those are really, not that we all crave whoopie pies all day long, but you know what I mean. It's those formative things and kids wanting to be able to be like the other kids and so forth.
Exactly. You know, my lunch looked very different from everyone else's, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but I certainly noticed it as a child.
Yeah.
And even as an adult, sometimes I'll notice it. You know, I'll go to a wedding or go to someone's home for dinner, and I can tell that they feel really anxious about what they're going to serve me. So, you know, being at the table has always brought with it lots of joy. Mm-hmm. But also a little bit of trepidation, and sometimes just feeling more than a little left out.
Right. So you've done previous books, as I mentioned in the introduction, about gluten-free baking and cooking, and this new one is called World's Easiest Paleo Baking. So what is paleo? What does that mean? I mean, I think we all think it means being a meathead, as I always say.
Right.
Because I'm a vegetarian, so I say other people are meatheads, so sorry.
No, and that's exactly what I thought. I actually met Michelle Tam, who writes the fantastic blog Nom Nom Paleo, mm-hmm. and we were at a conference together, and she said to me something along the lines of, do you do paleo baking? And I had no idea what she meant.
Right.
I had the reaction, right? I just thought, paleo, doesn't that mean all you eat is meat, like, all the time?
Right, is that lamb chop cupcakes?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I learned pretty quickly, and Michelle was very kind to clue me in, that folks who follow, you know, a paleo diet are eating lots of fresh fruits and vegetables. Most include meat in their diet. There are some vegetarian paleos out there, but most do include meat in their diet. And they also avoid grains.
Oh.
So no grains. Yeah.
Okay.
And no legumes. So what do you do with that? And so many of my readers, you know, Margaret, it was amazing to me how quickly I went from talking to folks about gluten-free baking to suddenly people had questions about grain-free baking. How do you bake with almond flour? How do you bake with coconut flour? And I wanted to learn along with them so I could answer some questions, you know? So that was my first introduction to paleo. So in the book, it means no grains and no dairy. Some paleo folks include dairy in their diet, and others do not. So I just avoided it altogether.
Okay, and so then that means if it's grain-free, it's also gluten-free? I mean,
yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yep.
Okay. So so let's talk about flours because, again, you know, I shop at a food co-op and, you know, that shelf just keeps growing. It's got more things on it, and I'm fascinated, and they range in price and color and the names and, you know what I mean, there's really a lot going on there in what used to be kind of white and wheat. It's not that anymore. Now, your adventure started long before the paleo appropriate flour, so maybe we go back a little bit before this current book, yeah?
Yeah, I think it's good to step back and say, you know, why do folks want to bake gluten-free? There are many folks who bake gluten-free because they have celiac disease, which is an autoimmune disorder, or they have other dietary restrictions, or perhaps they just don't feel good if they include wheat and other gluten grains in their diet.
Right.
So what that means for them is no wheat, rye, barley. Oats are sort of in this gray area depending on how they're processed. So those are our big gluten-containing grains, wheat, rye, and barley.
Okay.
So when I first started baking gluten-free, we were lucky if we could find white rice flour at the grocery store. That was sort of exciting. If we were really lucky, we might have found brown rice flour and sorghum flour.
Uh-huh.
And that was it. I mean, that was it. And like you said, now you go in and there's millet flour, garbanzo bean flour, coconut flour. These are all gluten-free flours, and they all behave very differently. They behave differently from wheat flour, and they behave differently from each other. So that's sort of where it gets a little confusing if you're trying to bake gluten-free.
Right. So, and this is where your Culinary Institute of America training comes in, right? Because you, and I had to crack up in the book, you talk about, you confess, I guess, that with some of the, an average recipe in the testing, or maybe this is on your website, that it may be 30 attempts to get a recipe right, 30 tries. It does not like you go, oh, I think I'm going to make some blah, blah, and these are what I'm going to throw in it, and hey, that's done. 30 times around to get it right. And you're a professional. Yeah.
And I'm a bit of a pain when it comes to getting the texture just right.
Right.
I think it's good to admit that any gluten-free flour, whether we're talking about white rice flour or coconut flour, no gluten-free flour behaves like wheat flour.
Right.
And I think it's a bit of like wrong-headed thinking to try and apply the rules of wheat flour to gluten-free baking. Because gluten, if we can talk about that for a second, even though we're discussing gluten-free baking,
right.
Gluten is so exciting and so essential. It provides these long, elastic strands in baking. That means that if you're making pizza dough, you know, we've all seen a pizzeria where someone, you know, tosses that pizza dough above their head. It's the strands of gluten that's allowing that to happen.
Right.
With gluten-free baking, we don't have those long, elastic strands. So what can happen is our breads can be very, very dense and very heavy. So we not only look to the flowers to bring structure, but we also look to other ingredients like eggs. So a lot of times in gluten-free bread, even if it's, you know, what we would know as a lean dough, in traditional wheat baking, that would just be flour, water, salt, and yeast. And in gluten-free baking, we tend to add eggs, so we have that protein structure.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so we're not just looking at the flours. We're actually looking at what everything brings to the recipe.
Okay, so again, you applied your learning from your professional culinary training, but you also acknowledge that it's not going to be the same. We're not going to have these long strands of elasticity, so to speak, that we have in our wheat or rye or barley. And so we're doing something slightly different. Nevertheless, like we were talking about earlier, we still crave certain things. We want a yellow cake, or we want a pizza crust, or we want such and such muffin. We still want these things, these familiar flavors and forms. Yeah,
exactly. And for cakes and cookies, they're actually can be quite similar. Breads can be different, but different isn't always bad, mm-hmm. because the beauty of these flours is that wheat flour is a little bit boring. Just, you know, it's wheat, it's sort of bland. There was a time in my life before I was diagnosed with celiac where I could eat wheat, so I know what it tastes like.
Right.
Sorghum flour and millet flour, very, very flavorful, and that's wonderful. Coconut flour is super flavorful. So although we're giving up a little in the texture department and in the workability department, we gain so much in the flavor department. I have lots of folks who are not gluten-free for any specific reason, but there are some gluten-free baked treats that they love because the flavor is really good. It's really intense. You tend to use less sugar. It's just a different way of thinking about baked goods.
Right. Well, that was what's interesting at the class that I came to that you taught, is that, for instance, it was a cookie that was made with almond flour and had very few other ingredients. But it was, and you didn't put a lot of, you put maple syrup, I believe, in it, a dark maple syrup. But it was a very small amount of that, actually. And yet the flavor was sweet, naturally sweet and delicious, and they were satisfying. So it wasn't like I was being cheated, which really interested me, because I've stared at these bags of almond flour. And that's not a cheap ingredient, by the way. That's not something that's the same price as white flour. You know what I mean? So it's a special ingredient, and so
yes.
You know, you might hesitate to buy it on a whim if you didn't know what to do with it. So let's talk about some. You mentioned sorghum flour, millet flour, other ones. You mentioned rice, brown rice flour, for instance. Any others that sort of have been along the journey?
Those are the sorghum, millet, and white rice flours are the flours that I reach for the most.
Uh-huh.
I tend to avoid legume flour. So I don't love garbanzo bean flour, mm-hmm. because it's heavy and it brings a bean flavor with it. Some folks love it, but I really, if I'm not working with a coconut flour or an almond flour, I want something that's sort of in the same flavor profile.
Okay.
It might be a little different, but garbanzo bean flour is sort of outside the scope of just the palette that I like. It's
well,
too beany
right,
for me.
If we were doing Indian cooking, maybe we would
yes.
be using it. Yeah. I
exactly.
get what you mean.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. All right.
So those are the flours. You know, if you've never baked gluten-free before, I would suggest starting with sorghum and millet flour. Those are two really flavorful, nutritious flours. And I would also bring some white rice flour into the pantry, because that flour actually fades into the background. And sometimes you want that. Sometimes you don't want a huge flavor punch. You do want something that takes a back seat. So those are the first three that I would bring home.
Okay.
And then, we're talking about flours, but I have to bring up starches.
I know. It's funny. That always confuses me, the starches. You know, and when I read the labels of baked goods that are labeled gluten-free, a lot of times one of the primary ingredients is like potato starch or tapioca
yes.
starch, and I get confused, you know, and I'm like, well, wait a minute, what's that?
Yes. starches, again, bring body to the table. Mm-hmm. So without that stretchy gluten, we need something that will provide a little bit of elasticity. It's not the same, but it does bring some to the table.
Okay.
And the two you mentioned, tapioca starch and potato starch, are fabulous for that. Tapioca starch is great for grain-free baking as well as gluten-free baking. I use it throughout the Paleo Baking book. It actually allowed me to knead bagels so I could take the dough and you can like sort of mix the dough and knead it. It's nice and elastic, and so you do want to add that to your flour blend. Without the addition of starch in some recipes, you don't need it in all recipes, but in some recipes, it adds the lightness and the stretchiness that you need, and it's so important.
Okay. I noticed, for instance, and I'm glad you're explaining that, because I noticed in the Paleo Baking book that, like, the brownies or chocolate chip bars or soft chocolate chip cookies don't have the tapioca starch in them, whereas some of the little firmer cookies and crackers and so forth do. Am I saying that right?
Yeah. You are getting that exactly right. So, yeah, if you think about, you know, walking into a professional bake shop, you don't see all-purpose flour.
Right.
You see, you know, bread flour, cookie flour, pastry flour. Think of starches as sort of moving more toward the bread flour category.
Right.
So they add a firmness and a stretchiness that is wonderful for bagels, pizza crusts, things like that. For a delicate little cookie, you don't need it.
I see. So are any of, I meant to also ask, are any of these ingredients, like when you were at the CIA studying, are any of these ingredients used in conventional baking at all, or are they only for this sort of special diet market, or, I mean, were they in the repertoire there?
Well, I was there in the late 1990s.
Yeah.
So it was not part of the curriculum while
okay.
I was there.
Okay.
And I'm guessing that's changed because, you know, the diets of Americans seem to be changing. I could see these flours being incorporated, especially something like almond flour.
Yeah.
You mentioned it's really expensive.
Yeah.
You know, let's be honest. A bag of it can cost anywhere from $10 to $15.
Yes.
So it's expensive, but it is a nut flour. So I think in traditional pastries, you would see that used.
Yeah, and the other thing that's interesting, of course, about all these flours we're talking about, if you look at and the starches as well, they have different nutritional qualities besides having different elasticity or lack of same compared to, say, wheat or more common flours. They also have different nutritional profiles. So, you know, like tapioca, not so much, like no fiber, I think, at all, compared
right.
to, say, like almond flour, where it's like lots of fiber, protein, good fats. So they're all very different in terms of what you get out of them by adding them, nutritionally speaking. I saw on the Bob's Red Mill website has like a nutritional profile of every single one that they sell. So that's like one easy place if people want to look up. And there's probably better places, but, you know, I found that interesting to look into.
I think that's a great resource because as we look to varying our diets, we don't always want to be hitting the same things, you know, day in and day out, same flours,
right.
same, you know, yogurt for breakfast,
right.
same thing for lunch. And a real easy way to do it, and, you know, treats should be that. They should be treats. So we don't want to look to our chocolate chip cookies to provide a huge nutritional boost to our diet. But if you're going to enjoy, you know, I always like to say that, but if you're going to eat the chocolate chip cookie anyway, why not get some added benefits from it?
So in our lab, we have 4 minutes left, and I want to talk about some of the other ingredients a little bit, and I hope we can provide, I was thinking maybe we provide one of the recipes that in the transcript that goes along with this conversation on the website, but it's not just the flours also that make the difference in baking. Like, I was fascinated. Your book is so... there's so much learning to be had in the book. Like, for instance, even ingredients in tiny proportions like salt, you can't just leave the salt out because you don't like to use salt. Like, it has an action that it performs, yes?
Yes.
Yeah, so things like that, what does that do?
Oh, we could have spent 20 minutes talking about salt.
Uh-oh.
I mean, I love flour, but salt... salt is really important. It's a flavor enhancer.
Yeah.
So in some type of, you know, baked goods like chocolate chip cookies or brownies, you might look and say, oh, it's only a quarter teaspoon of salt or a half teaspoon of salt. It actually enhances the flavors in baked goods.
Right. And when there's yeast involved, does it also have an action?
Yeah. When we're talking about yeast baking, and this holds true whether we're talking about gluten-free, grain-free, or traditional baking, when yeast is involved, salt will control yeast growth. And that's important. You know, you might think that you just want the yeast to go crazy, but if you have your yeast producing too much and your bread dough just expands too much, as you bake it, it can collapse onto itself in the oven. And if you leave the salt out of a yeast bread recipe, the bread will taste really flat. It almost has a cottony flavor to it. It tastes so flat.
Right.
So yeast and salt are really important, but I have to say, you never want to add salt directly to your yeast mixture because it will control the yeast growth in your dough.
Right.
But if added directly to the yeast mixture, it will kill your yeast.
I was going to say too much, right? It would be too much for the living yeast, yeah.
Yep. So you whisk it into the flour mixture, and that ensures that it's not in direct contact with the yeast mixture.
So a couple of quick questions as we finish up. If I want to make gravy for friends who are gluten-free, what flour would I use to add to my gravy where I might just use a normal, you know, white flour?
Yep, you have two options. If your friends are strictly gluten-free,
uh-huh.
I love sweet rice flour.
Sweet rice
it's made
flour.
It's made from glutinous rice, so it's like sticky rice.
Yes.
And it makes a beautiful gravy. If your friends are grain-free, reach for tapioca starch.
Okay.
Like you would do with cornstarch, use tapioca starch, and that's totally grain-free. It's a gravy that will taste like a starch-thickened gravy, but it's very good.
And there was one final question. True Confessions, Elizabeth Bourbon, how many takes did it take to figure out the paleo, gluten-free, grain-free bagels? It was overwhelming. I was so impressed. You did it. I guess it was a lot, huh?
We had so many bagels in bags in the freezer because I didn't want to be throwing them away, although it got to the point where my husband said, you're testing these recipes. These are inedible. They have to go. but there were lots and lots of tests. But the bagels, grain-free bagels, and you boil the dough, well, simmer the dough, they're fabulous. And they were so worth the work. But yeah, there are lots of almond flour went to that cause, I have to be honest with you.
Well, I'm going to try to sneak maybe one of those recipes away from you, as I said, Elizabeth, to share with the transcript. And also, of course, we're going to have a book giveaway of World's Easiest Paleo Baking, Gluten-Free, Grain-Free, Dairy-Free, and with No Refined Sugars, your newest book. I'm so glad to speak to you. And I'll also, of course, include information about some of the classes you're going to be giving that are coming up near me and elsewhere. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I loved chatting about flour and salt and all sorts of other good things with you.
Well, I feel much more informed, and now I may dare to purchase some of those flours and give them a test drive in my kitchen. Thank you.
Yay.
Yay. And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week. Don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes. And you can find me anytime at facebook.com/awaytogarden or awaytogarden.com. Happy seed starting and baking meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.